Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Leading the Way Radio Show, where each time you'll hear from successful women CEOs, executives, and professionals, where we'll discover how they do what they do to be successful in business. We'll be interviewing women who have overcome big challenges, women who have incredible stories of lessons learned in dealing with adversity. We'll even interview women who have started and grown successful organizations and women who are C-level executives with unique talents and positions. Our goal is to bring successful businesswomen together to share how they're leading the way in business today.
Good morning. My name is Tammy Erickson, and I'm delighted to be a guest today on Women Leading the Way. My background and expertise is in diversity. I've spent the past 30 years looking at companies and understanding why people get excited about work and what it is that makes us different, why some of us like some things and some of us like others. What is it that really gets at the heart of what gets us all engaged? And over that time, I've learned some interesting things about teamwork and what we as leaders can do to create effective teams in our organizations. In one piece of research, I found that the most surprising finding was that teams function best when our roles are well-defined. Now, I found that surprising because I've probably spent much of my career doing exactly the opposite, thinking that the best way to create a team was to leave the roles somewhat vague and ambiguous. Let people overlap, because surely if they had overlapping responsibilities, they'd want to work together to resolve a particular common interest. It turns out that's not true, that in fact, the research shows that the teams that are most collaborative and most productive are ones where the roles on the team are well defined. Now, clearly, people can change roles from team to team, so it's not like you have to be pigeonholed, but it is very clear that on a specific team, it's understood what your role will be. Think of it a little bit like the old symphony example. Nobody's unclear about which part the flute is going to play versus the trombone. Those parts are clearly defined, and everyone knows what it is, and that comes together to create great harmony.
Hey, Tammy, you sound like you just know amazing stuff. I got to ask you, like, how did you get involved, and how did you get into dealing with diversity and looking at how teams interact and work with each other in the workplace? How did you get into this? This is Michelle, by the way.
Well, my background is actually started with innovation. So I began early on doing consulting work for one of the major consulting companies, and I was working with pharmaceutical companies primarily, trying to understand why some were more effective in their R&D departments than others.
Right.
And it was out of getting to know, thinking about innovation and why some companies were more innovative, that I began to get more and more interested in what creates that spark of innovation. Why are some people more innovative? Why are some more collaborative? Why are some more willing to share new ideas and dig deep?
No,
why
I love
are some
that.
More
it's
engaged?
Funny. What are some of the things that you see as far as innovation? It's like, what are companies doing that kind of hit that spark, if you will, where they really have diversity among teams and there's a collaborative spirit? Do you have, like, maybe a couple of stories that you can tell of innovative companies and what they're doing?
Well, I think there's two levels to the question. So it turns out that the companies that have the greatest sense of spark, if you will, that have highly engaged employees who really contribute to an innovative effort, first, they tend to be quite idiosyncratic. They tend to be companies that have a clear sense of who they are and are able to convey a clear confidence about their culture, their values, etc., that people really understand the meaning of being part of the organization. The second, though, is that they also put in place a number of very practical organizational characteristics that help people create those connections. And one, as I was explaining, is they clearly defined roles, just as people do in a symphony, or the example I was going to give is people in hospitals who understand clearly what role they play in the ER. It turns out that particular example is very important to translate into the corporate world, that as you set up innovative teams, you need to make sure that people's roles are as clearly understood as who's going to be the surgeon and who's going to be the scrub nurse in a hospital setting.
What do companies do to be able to, like, do they hire according to, like, personalities for that? Is it through the training that they get that innovation? I mean, how do you instill that and kind of create that spirit in an organization? I'm curious. I mean, what tactically do you see companies doing to kind of get that teamness, the innovation going? What are they doing?
Well, again, I'd go back to the two things that I mentioned. So if I talk more about the first, this sense of creating engagement and commitment and passion within the workforce, that all comes from the company's sense of uniqueness. So it's very important that a company is able to be clear about their values. And now some companies are very team-oriented. Some are very high risk, high adrenaline. Some are very purposeful in terms of trying to change the world or working toward a particular legacy. The interesting thing is it doesn't really matter in terms of what your company is, as long as you're true to it, as long as you align your employee experience so that it actually conforms to what those values are. So if you say you're team-based, boy, you better be team-based. You better be team-based in every aspect. And then you'll attract people who like being in a team-based organization, and they'll get excited about being reinforced through team-based kinds of experiences in the workplace. So that's kind
of
at the heart.
Yeah, do you have a company that you could give an example of how they're doing that? I mean, as you mentioned, hospitals.
Well, sure.
Is there an example?
Yeah, sure. So a company that's really good on the team front would be Whole Foods, the food store. They actually hire people and tell them upon hiring that they're going to be on probation for a month, and that at the end of the time, their teammates will vote whether or not they get to stay. So this is, a very strong practice because, as you could imagine, it creates kind of a palpable sense of how committed they are to teamwork. You know, think of it for a second, what the difference would be if I put a poster on the wall that said, "We value teamwork," versus I told you you were going to be on probation and your teammates were going to vote. It's a pretty big difference in terms of gut-level impact. And so Whole Foods has the probation practice. They also then go on to align many other aspects of the employee experience around teams. So, for example, people are paid based on team performance. They're evaluated based on team performance. So the entire mechanisms within the Whole Foods organization operate on a team basis. That would be quite different than other organizations, which might operate on a very, very different kind of model. Again, the key isn't which model you choose, it's that you're consistent and clear in communicating that model throughout your organization.
Gotcha. And, you know, I've heard so many HR executives that'll share with me, man, it's just really hard managing different generations today. You know, you've got the 20-somethings that culturally they're looking for a different way to be, quote-unquote, managed or promoted. I mean, what do you find from a generational standpoint? You know, in some of your research and the things you've watched among companies and what they do well in managing the generations as teams?
There are important generational differences. The generational differences actually relate to our initial perceptions about what we like and what we fear, what we trust, what we aspire for. They also relate to a lot of our kind of housekeeping perceptions about how we get things done, how important regular schedules are, for example, or asynchronous work. So a manager of a multi-generational team has to be thinking about both things, both how will certain events in the workplace look to different members of different generations, and what kind of assumptions might they be bringing about some of our more mechanical housekeeping details. On the latter, for example, many younger employees today don't really get the importance of regular hours. I've had one say to me, you know, what's with these people and 8:30 a.m.? Why do they care so much about 8:30?
Right.
I was up late last night getting the report done. So managers have to be sensitive to those differences, and my recommendation is always just bring them out, put them on the table for the group to talk about. How important is it in our group for the work that our team is doing that we all share the same hours, or do we not care? Is it fine with us if people work asynchronously, different hours during the day? And have a group discussion about that is probably the simplest and easiest way to handle it.
You know, I always find it so fascinating with companies because I deal with a lot of HR directors, and they're always saying, oh, my gosh, you know, the different generations, you know, our 50 and 60-somethings, they feel like that the 20 and 30-somethings, they don't get how we roll, right, as a term, if I can think of that. And then the 20-somethings say, man, you know, how we communicate is just so oil and water. And I is that something you deal with in companies of how to bring those generations together more, I guess, synergistically? Because I find that, you know, one says A, the other's thinking B, and it's like, you know, we all just want to get along and get the job done. But sometimes the communication styles even are much different. Even though the values are put out and shared and maybe common, it's just it's the communication process that sometimes among generations is a really tough thing. Do you find that?
I do find that. And I think to some extent those things are inevitable. And let me give you an example. The basis of the work that I do on the generations actually goes back to developmental psychology. And what we know from developmental psychology is that different people form different views of how the world works, interestingly, largely between the ages of 11 and 15. That turns out to be kind of the golden age when kids really begin to wrestle with ideas about who they're afraid of, who they respect, what they want from life, what they think they need to do to be safe and successful in their life. And they form those impressions by watching the events that are unfolding around them and listening to their parents discuss them and others, adults discuss them and so forth. And so because different generations would have experienced very different climates, very different events, sets of events when they were 11 to 15, we tend to fear different things and respect different people and want different things out of our life. A classic example in the workplace would be around the issue, let's say, of relocation. If you say to someone who's in their late 50s and 60s today, in other words, a baby boomer, we'd like you to relocate. Now, they're likely to see that as basically good news because what they're hearing embedded in that statement is, we've selected you. You've been chosen. We've considered a lot of people, and out of all the people we've considered, you're the best. You're the one we want to relocate. And so a boomer will hear the compliment that's embedded in that statement. People in their 30s and 40s, however, grew up at a time when, in many cases, they formed a pretty valid and deep mistrust of institutions. And rather than hearing the compliment, they're likely to hear, boy, this is a big anonymous institution that's asking me to uproot my family and my friends and move to a strange place where I'd be putting all of my eggs in one basket.
Right,
so they're
right.
likely to hear the uncertainty and the risk associated with putting their eggs in one institutional basket. So it's not so much that so the communication is part of it, it's not that they didn't both understand that the company wanted them to relocate. It's that the very fundamental idea of relocation triggers a very different emotion among generations. In one, it's a compliment. In other, it's a threat. And so we react to them very differently.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think, too, it's like, what do you see as the biggest challenge for companies to bring in, like you mentioned earlier about the kind of common values and sharing that among all the team members and, creating that kind of like inspirational, here's our top-notch values. What do you find is the biggest challenges in companies sharing that, implementing that, and then, of course, having employees step up, to act within those values? What do you find are the biggest challenges?
Well, I think the biggest challenge for most companies in terms of implementing their unique values is kind of getting out of their own way. It's getting the confidence, in a sense, to say, these are our values. And to be able, and similarly, to be able to say, and we don't do that. If you want that, go somewhere else. That's not us. We don't do that. We do this. If you want this, come here. So in other words, we're a high-risk environment. You want high-risk, high-reward, come here. You want long-term security, we don't do that. You go somewhere else. Or vice versa. We offer long-term security. You want a lot of high-risk compensation, we don't do that. Go somewhere else. So you've got to be comfortable saying what you are and equally saying what you're not. And you've got to be willing to say that, in a sense, before I join, preferably, so that I make the decision that I want to join you. There's really interesting research that people who get realistic previews of what it's like at work have remarkably different tenures with the organization than people who get, basically unrealistic or no previews of what it's going to be like to work there. So in other words, the more you can tell me honestly, hey, when you get here, it's going to be really risky, and we're going to move you around, and you won't know which end is up, and it's going to be, totally exciting or whatever, whatever. And you, if you listen to that and say, wow, that's exactly what I'm looking for, and you choose to join with that kind of a pre-warning, if you will, you're likely to stay. But if I don't tell you that, and you're a person who really wants a lot of security, you're going to leave.
Well, and this is why I love this, because so many companies will take the time to do personality assessments. They at the hiring point, they will say, well, tell me about you and how you're wired. And yet part of that match, if I hear you correctly, is to say a company needs to do a good job of when they interview and who they recruit is to see if there's a good match, but also the person interviewing. I mean, they need to say, am I going to be a good fit here? Are we a good match? Is that correct?
Yeah. That's correct.
And how does somebody,
in fact, I'm not a big fan of doing personality assessments because I think that has I think it has a very paternalistic feel to it. It sort of says, I, the organization, am going to be able to figure out whether you would like it here, honey, instead of simply saying, let me tell you what it's like here, and you're an adult, you figure out if you'd like it. I mean, I like it a lot better if I let you figure it out. I'll tell you honestly what it's like to work here. You figure out if it's going to work for you. You're an adult. I don't have to, do some kind of an assessment to figure out if you're going to like it.
Well, and let me share with you, because our listeners that are on today on our show, it's like, we have women that are in transition, that are executive women, women owners, women looking for new opportunities, and what the job market is like. What would you suggest to them that are listening who are maybe in executive search mode of what they can do to look for a company that's a good fit for them in the interview process? I mean, I'm kind of curious, as they're interviewing, that job one is to get the interview, but even then it should be part of our job as we're interviewing to say, hey, am I a good match here? What should they do? What would you suggest?
Well, the first thing is I think they've got to really get clear in their own mind about the kinds of work that gets them excited. So I always encourage people to think of times when you've lost yourself in your work. When have you been the most passionate about the work you've been doing, and what were the characteristics of that situation? Was it something that was very secure and stable, or was it something that was very uncertain and risky? Was it team-based, or was it solo? Was it public, or was it, more back room? What are the characteristics that really get you excited about work? And the more comfortable you are about yourself, I think you're going to be able to exude that through the interview process. And then it is a tough, challenge, but you really need to find that match, because it's not a win-win for you or the organization if you end up force-fitting yourself into a place that's very different than what you are authentically. There's a lot of research that shows that if you try to do that, in other words, make yourself into something you're not, you know, it's a very outgoing organization and you're a very introverted backroom kind of person or something, I mean, you're just going to be miserable and you're not going to put forth your best effort and it's not going to be a long-term win-win for you or the company. So it's in both of your best interests to be as frank and honest as possible about who you are and what they are at those cultural levels.
No, it does. And I know our time is so limited because this always goes so fast, but, you know, can you share with our listeners, I mean, if someone wants to reach you, this is your time, how would you like people to connect with you? Do you want to share your website or your email address with us? Or how would someone reach you if they have questions based on what we're talking about?
Sure. I'm happy to answer questions. My website is www.tammyerickson, spelled TammyErickson.com. And my email address is just about the same. It's Tammy@TammyErickson.com. So I'm happy to be contacted by email. And if you go on the website, you'll find lots of resources, papers I've written, books, articles, et cetera, that I hope will be helpful.
Cool, cool. And then what are maybe two things you can share? We also have decision makers and executives listening in, I know, that are probably looking for more effective ways to find the right people. What would be maybe, you know, some nuggets or suggestions you would have as they try to find, obviously, a good fit? And I, you know, I'm somebody who hires and I do use personality assessment. So that's fascinating to me that it really does make sense that you have to interview to see if somebody is going to embrace the values that your company exhibits. What would you suggest for an employer to kind of bring in the right people and ask the right questions of somebody on the interview side? What would a company do, even if they have their values outlined and they know the kind of person they're looking for? How does that work with who they interview? What would you suggest?
I would say the first is to come up with what I like to call a signature experience. You want to have a story or two that you can tell about what will happen to that individual during their employment that will create a gut-level reaction in the individual. So in other words, one organization says to people, basically, we're not going to assign you a job right away. When you come, we're going to put you through 3 months of rotation. You're going to be in a different job every day, or not every day, every week, and you'll go to sales and marketing and product development and whatever, whatever. And over this time, we're going to scrutinize you closely and watch every move. And at the end of the 3 months, we'll figure out where you fit in. Now, that's the kind of story that I can think about at a gut level. I can react to that and decide whether that's the kind of environment that I would be comfortable in. It obviously says we're an organization that values ambiguity and flexibility and willingness to take risks. Mm-hmm. It's much more powerful to tell the story than it is to say the adjectives. So don't say to people, we value ambiguity. Tell them a story about how their days are going to be that will in itself convey the idea that it's going to be a very ambiguous environment. If your company doesn't have a story, then you're not there yet. The second challenge I give companies,
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you. Forgive me.
The second challenge I give companies is I want to imagine that you're going to hire somebody and you're not going to tell them anything about your corporate values. You're not going to say one word. And at the end of 6 months, you're going to ask them what your corporate values are. Would they be able to state them? And so that's the second test. And if the answer to that is no, you're not there yet. So you want to make sure that in those first, let's say, 6 months, and obviously it should continue on beyond that, but I'll just give you the six-month challenge. In the first 6 months, if your values are, I don't know, learning and teamwork, that's what you really care a lot about. After 6 months, would I say to anybody who asks, man, this is a company that really values learning and teamwork, because I've spent 6 months immersed in learning and teamwork. And if the answer is no, then you're not there. You don't have the kind of environment that has the clarity that's going to allow you to attract people who will really get psyched about your environment. Again, let me emphasize, doesn't matter what you choose, but you've got to be true to whatever it is.
And here's my final question to you, my dear. First of all, thank you so much for your time, because I know that, you know, Cecile and I, which she's not on the show today, unfortunately, but I know she has talked about the amazing articles. Now, am I understanding you're also a book author, is that correct?
That's correct. I've written a number of books.
Oh, I love it. And it's such a specialty, because I think so many companies are always trying to find the right mix, you know, the right group of people. It's like finding that synergy. What would be a couple of final thoughts that you would share with our listeners about, you know, trying to find diversity among their team, among their staff and their, you know, their workforce? What would be a couple of nuggets that you would suggest as our wrap-up, unfortunately? And thank you for your time.
Well, I guess I'll just offer one, and that is count to 10. So next time somebody in the workplace does something that seems absolutely crazy to you, and believe me, it happens to me all the time, just count to 10 and ask yourself whether it might not be because they, in a sense, are coming at it from a very different perspective, whether that's a different gender perspective, a different generational perspective, ethnic, cultural, whatever. But it's probably their perspective on the world that's causing them to have a different reaction, not because they're less competent or less bright or whatever. And so hold that judgment and look for the real difference.
You know what? That is such great advice, and I have to share with you, because as an employer, I run a small business, and I have to laugh because quite a few years ago, this is when, you know, everything was about, you know, now texting. And I remember that I had staff that were on part-time, you know, schedules. And so when we would have a change in schedule, I would try to call one of the staff members, too. Many of them were college, young 20-somethings, and I would call and leave a message. And seriously, Tammy, it would take them 2 or 3 days to get back to me. And I'm thinking, what's going on? And yet when I talked to a couple of the staff members, they're like, well, just text me. I'll reply right away. And I was like, well, I never thought about that. And so then I started texting them any changes to the schedule, and it was like, we just had great synergy. And it was that one small thing to our operation that made such a difference, because we had a moving schedule and, you know, people that had schedules would switch, and it was just such a better mode to communicate with them. But as an employer, I didn't realize that until, you know, a couple of the staff members said, hey, if you text me, I can get back to you. It's not that I'm ignoring you. They live on text. They don't check their voicemail. Like some of
very,
us
very important to withhold that judgment and try to find out what the underlying cause is. Absolutely.
No, great advice. Great advice. My dear, our time is up. I just want to say thank you so much for your time and being flexible on the radio this morning. I do want to tell everyone listening today, tell Tammy Erickson, thank you so much for your time. And folks that are listening, we will see you back next week for our next Women Leading the Way radio show. So thank you, Tammy, for being our leading lady today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Women Leading the Women Leading the Way is produced by Connected Women of Influence, the premier private membership organization where life-focused, business-to-business executive and professional women connect, collaborate, and cultivate a vast network of high-level affiliations, resources, and professional relationships. For more information about Connected Women of Influence, please visit our website at connectedwomenofinfluence.com.